Those of you who came and found this to be a complete waste of time, and about all I can say is, as far as I'm concerned, I apologize. The third group, and I hope there's some at least in the third group, are those who may have felt that they were overloaded in some ways and are beginning or have begun already to sort out, when I get home now, just what do I, in a sense, take home with me, and what do I discard in the way, and what do I file away after I get home to use later, and where do we begin? And my comment to you, if there are any of you, is don't overload the system. And we have a tendency, and this is a part of the reentry problem Paul mentioned, is for pastors and lay people to come away from an event like this and go home and overload the system. And I think, as I indicated before, and as Paul has mentioned, there are some problems with this, and I'd like to spend most of this hour talking one way and another about this question of reentry and how do we work with lay people back home. And for the most part, we're addressing this to parish pastors, to a very limited degree to the district folks. I find it's helpful for me, and I find congregations that do this, and I find districts and other regional administrative units in the church that do this to usually find it helpful, if we have some kind of frame of reference, a window that we look out through to see the world out here that tells us what's out there and gives us some indication of what we're about, and also some kind of yardstick on which to base or build our priorities. Let me use as an illustration of this a synod, including your district, in the LCA. And this was a frame reference developed by the synod staff. And if I remember this correctly, and I think I do, they said, in effect, the frame reference we use as we look at the kinds of demands that are made of staff and sort these out in terms of priority would be, first of all, we have a shepherding responsibility as synod staff for pastors and parishes, and very deliberately put those two in that order. Now, this obviously included the synod president's responsibility for placement, but also included other shepherding responsibilities for pastors and parishes. The second, which was proposed by what I would have regarded before I got there from knowing some things before, as far and away the most conservative and the strongest traditionalist in the group, was what came to be the second of these: facilitate change in the parish. And the synod staff saw themselves with this as their second priority as they sort out the demands on them. And the third, and I don't remember the exact word they used, but in effect it was to help enhance the worship experiences for the people in the parish. And they were saying, we are using this as we try to identify who and what we're doing. If somebody asks the question, how are things going in the synod, then we use this as the outline or frame of reference and respond to that question. As we get requests and we have to make choices between what's top priority and what's a lower priority, we deal with those three as the yardsticks for setting the top priorities. Now, I'm not trying to endorse those three in terms of content. I am endorsing the concept. And I'd like to lift up a couple of points here, one major and one minor, in terms of the life of the parish today. And you pick it up and discard this and substitute your own and build it on in terms of your own frame of reference for looking at the life in your parish. There was a day, and to some extent, we are all victims of, as we look back, whether we do this individually or as congregations, we're all victims of what I read of several months ago as I was approaching my 50th birthday, and that's why it stuck in my mind, a statement which I suspect was made in jest, but I take it somewhat seriously, about one of the most common characteristics of 50-year-old men. Most of what they remember isn't true. It never happened. Much of what we remember never happened. Much of what parishes remember never happened, particularly as we remember the good old days. Nevertheless, I think there was a point in our history, in our society, when the typical individual who was a member of a worshiping congregation and involved in working somewhere in the world outside of the church and with certain kinds of family responsibilities, this individual gradually began to see the world of work becoming increasingly complex. Perhaps the people who felt this the most were the farmers in the United States, because farming has changed more rapidly than any other major occupation as far as the nature of the changes, the impact of the changes, and the pace of the changes. This is true, though, of a great many other vocations and occupations, and one of the comforts would be to come away from this very confused, unstable work world, so to speak, and come back to a reasonably stable, predictable set of circumstances in the family or in the school or in the church. And the schools began to change some years ago, and it's increasingly difficult for parents to relate to the school system because the changes that have taken place there make it different than when I was in school. And a great many parents see schools today, whether you're talking about elementary schools or institutions of higher education, as anything but stable. And I even know of some denominations that take that kind of view in seminaries. In other words, we don't have the degree of predictability we'd like to have. We've had the same kind of thing happen with the family, where increasingly, and I speak now simply for the man, increasingly for the husband, the father, the family is not as predictable as it was. And all that's left is the church. Now, a part of how we can respond to this is to say, no, nothing is predictable. And there are some people who are suggesting today that all of us need some point of what are increasingly being called stability zones, some point that we can relate to where we can anticipate what's going to happen and be reasonably correct, where we can have a degree of predictability about how it will be and not be disturbed because it doesn't turn out to be that way. And let me use a simple illustration as far as the parish is concerned with this. We have a lot of congregations that are introducing various new forms of worship, and I'll just use the umbrella phrase of contemporary worship, although I think that's a misleading kind of statement, and replacing the traditional service with this. The place I see it producing the greatest distress is in Roman Catholic parishes, where a great many lay people have been very much disturbed as in their parish the Mass is said in English rather than Latin. We see the same kind of thing in many Protestant congregations, and I think that perhaps a better way to approach this is a both and rather than either or, and that we give people choices. And those who want the very traditional service at 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock or 10:30, wherever the hour may be, that's there. And there may be something different for some other people, but we don't force people into one mold or another mold. And we see congregations using this approach, which 5 or 10 years ago would never have even considered for a minute the possibility of having two services on Sunday morning because they're simply too small. Now, the basic point I'm trying to make here is simply that as we look at the life of the parish, that we give serious consideration to giving people choices. We tend not to do this. As clergymen, we tend not to. As leaders, lay or clergy, we tend to say we have come to the conclusion that this is what is good and good for you, and therefore, if you can't accept this, then let's talk about what's wrong with you. And I think that as we talk about, you know, what are you going to do back home, the question of choices Needs to be a part of this picture and a part of the discussion, and in a sense a part of the frame of reference as to what choices are we really giving people. The biggest single choice that we've offered people in recent years in churches, and this is not quite as obvious, I don't think, in Lutheran Church Missouri Synod as it is in some other denominations, is that moved up on the list of real choices is the choice of staying away. Now, that's always been there. The only thing is that more people see that as the only viable option that's being offered. And I have some sympathy for these folks, because I think we should be offering them additional choices beyond the choice of staying away. I was with a fairly large congregation out in Topeka a year or so ago and said, "What are you offering? What choices are you offering people for worship on Sunday morning?" And they thought for a moment and said, "Well, depends how you count. I guess you'd say either two or three. We have an early service, 8:30. We have an 11 o'clock service. And I suppose if you want to count this, since we broadcast the 11 o'clock service over the radio, we're offering people the choice of staying home and listening to the radio, or go someplace and listen to the radio at 11 o'clock. And as we talked about this, we began to see other choices emerging. This is a church with a fairly strong adult Sunday school, and it was obvious that a great many people saw a fourth choice, which was to attend the adult Sunday school class and cross that off as far as taking care of the obligatory mass. We also saw some evidence that there are other people who said, "I have still another fifth choice, which is to go to some other congregation. Even though my membership is here, I don't have to be here on Sunday morning for worship." And then, of course, the sixth choice, which I referred to before, is we can stay away completely. And a congregation which would have said we're offering people two choices, or some might have said three choices for worship, was really offering six. And I think we need to look at this list of choices that we're offering people in a little more realistic way. The second comment, which is sort of a minor one, as I suggested, in terms of going back, and I'm speaking now in a more personal sort of way, is that hopefully there have been some reactions to what happened here. There are some reactions, and there will be some reactions in your mind, and I don't mean by reactions, reactionary reactions, but simply responses to the experiences here. And hopefully there will be some responses 3 and 6 and 9 and 12 months later. And I think we need to, see this way, that in a rather concentrated 10-day event such as this, not everything happens all at once. And as we reflect on this in time to come, there may be some benefits out of this experience which won't begin to appear even in your mind until the time goes by. Now, I'd like to make a couple of suggestions, for an agenda, and these are two different types of suggestions. One is directed toward the parish, and I want to spend most of the time on that. And the second one is as far as the team is concerned, and spend a smaller amount of time on this, but deal with it partly second, because I think sequentially in discussion comes second. Some of you may have a fairly long list of things that you want to undertake when you get back home. And some of you may have a short list, and some of you may have a list which is on a blank sheet of paper. I think we need to be very careful as we look at this list that we don't dump a whole load of hay all at one time, and particularly, though, that we sort out some things and begin to think specifically in two areas as we do this, and let me describe these then. On one of these, the proposal could be stated very simply. This is what we want to do, and then I raise the question, and who are the allies? Almost all of you are here without any allies, which means, among other things, that you probably will lose, at least initially, if you singularly, you alone, begin to introduce new ideas into an organization, whether it be a district or a parish. And if we think for a moment, as we've talked about this in other sessions here, the difference between a good idea and a bad idea begins to appear, and let me use as an illustration what one of the pastors here said to me. You know, I went back last year and talked with some of my leaders about the possibility of lay people doing certain kinds of calling. And these two men in particular just couldn't see this at all. And they had all kinds of reasons why they couldn't do any of this, and they could very easily project these as reasons why no one else could. And there was just no positive support for this idea of building a core of people who would be responsible for a caring ministry in that parish. In December, these two fellows said, you know what we ought to do? What we ought to do is take some of the load off the pastor in terms of certain kinds of calling responsibilities and spread this out among some of the lay people here. Now, I didn't probe the pastor who described this on this point, but as he was telling this, I thought to myself, now that's probably a good illustration of the difference between a good idea and a bad idea. By December, they had bought it and owned it, and it was theirs. And they may even have thought that they were introducing this for the first time and that the pastor had never thought about it, which is great. That's, no, don't misunderstand me. And as they proposed this, they got a very, very negative response from other members of the parish, who simply couldn't conceive of how in the world, you know, we could do this, so on and so forth. And the pastor said, and then I tried to explain to them that they were experiencing the same kind of thing I had experienced before, and hopefully they would also experience later what I was experiencing now. And I think this is a part of what we're talking about. In other words, you go back and you plant some seeds, and it takes some time before they germinate, and they don't all germinate. And when they do grow, they begin to grow, and in a sense, they're in someone else's garden, and that's great. And you may take some, you know, secret personal satisfactions out of this, but they're owned by someone else, and this is great. And therefore, part of what we're talking about here is going home and planting some seeds, and 6 months, a year and a half, 2 years before you know whether any of them germinated. The other part of this is, and here I would suggest that you limit this to a maximum of two and preferably one, would be some idea, some proposal, whatever it may be, for your parish. And you begin to go through the process, which is a fairly simple one to describe and a rather complicated one to follow, of how do you introduce a new idea into an organization to get acceptance. Now, a new idea suggests by the statement itself that there is some dissatisfaction with the status quo, otherwise you wouldn't be introducing a new idea. In other words, if you're completely happy with the way it is, you don't introduce new ideas. Frequently, we find that the beginning point in this, which is the matter of the degree of dissatisfaction, frequently that beginning point, there's one person there. That's the pastor. In other words, he is the only one who is discontented with the status quo. Therefore, before you even, in a sense, plant the seed, you have to enlarge the circle of discontent. Now, I'm not trying to suggest that you be a rabble-rouser or anything of the kind, but simply by asking questions, making suggestions here and there, looking at what we're doing and have other people look at it in the same, critical method, we may be able to find people who also are discontented. And then we can introduce the idea into this. In other words, the seedbed, so to speak, is one of discontent. Now, some of us are turned off immediately by this because what we want is a parish where everybody's contented. And until you serve such a situation, it looks pretty good. Now, the second step, which is the longest step from discontent, is from discontent to initiation. In other words, this is the longest step in the whole process. We all know, and you can apply this to the district or any other place, that we have a large number of people who are quite happy to sit around and gripe, but a much smaller number of people who are willing to initiate some proposal to do something about it and help carry that through. And therefore, we need to be very careful that we don't spend too much time on enlarging this circle of discontent, but begin to move in the second step, which is initiation, where we begin to initiate a new idea. And then we move very quickly from this to a third step, at least hopefully we move very quickly, which is where the idea for change is jointly owned. Now, this is a very threatening experience for any of us here, because most of us will operate in the assumption that if this is the problem, and this is my proposal to solve it, that probably, when you get right down to it, is the ideal solution. And it's pretty hard to conceive of any way that anybody could improve on that solution. And what becomes even more threatening is that as we talk with people and work this through, we see it begin to improve. And we see improvements that we had not even conceived as possible. Now, hopefully we can affirm these, and here we begin to move in, if I may go down a slide rope for just a moment, into another concept as far as how we look at the process. And this is the question of how does a group work and work effectively. And there are two or three things that have to be built into a group for a group of people to work effectively. And we're talking now about the allies that you have won to this particular cause and who are working with you and who have developed a proposal and now are refining this and seeking additional allies. For a group to work effectively, we not only have to listen to one another, and this is a point that's been stressed over and over, we have to credit and we have to build on others' contributions. One of the more difficult things for us to do is to credit others. And we don't have to make a big splash over this, but simply a few words or a phrase here and there where someone makes a contribution and your response or the response of someone else is, hey, now that's a good idea. That's it. You know, you don't have to bake a cake or anything of the kind. Or, golly, you know, I wish I'd thought of that. These kinds of things which say to the person who makes the contribution, they not only have been heard, but they've also been credited with making a positive contribution to the process. And that their contribution comes in and we build on this. It's very difficult to affirm and reaffirm too often. It is possible to affirm and reaffirm the contributions of one person too often. But as far as the group as a whole, it's almost impossible to overdo this. And if you're concerned with building a sense of affection within the group, somebody has to sort of be a model of how crediting and building on the contributions of others takes place. It's a fairly contagious process, and once it begins, you strengthen the whole group, which then, in a sense, begins this process of broadening the base of allies, and we start talking then about what might be done and who all might be involved in things like this. Now, here we come to two critical questions. Yes? Yeah. That's a good question. I would affirm the contribution and try to separate the contribution from the building process. In other words, don't say that's a lousy idea, in other words, but simply give credit, affirm, and let's hold this till later and see how we can build it in. But don't turn it off, you know, completely, because we tend to find it difficult to distinguish between rejecting a proposal or an idea or suggestion and rejecting a person. I mean, we tend to have difficulty doing this, and the person who hears us tends to have difficulty. And therefore, we can separate the affirmation, the supportive role, and this kind of thing. I do this, in groups like this, for example, and I suppose I've done it here. I haven't particularly been conscious of it, where I say to someone, you know, you're half a page ahead of me, or you're 2 pages ahead of me, or something like this. Or let's hold that for a minute. And it may or may not be something we're going to get to in another half page or another page. But, you know, this is a contribution, and I'm much more eager to say, you know, you're way ahead of me than to say you're off base. You know, just in terms of style. Now, maybe a base we don't want to touch, but nevertheless, simply the affirmation that they have been heard, which is very significant, and that this is, you know, you've heard what they said, this is significant, it may or may not tie in later. And sometimes it ties in later, but we don't use it. You know, we forget, you know, these kinds of things. And sometimes it may be, again, that if it is laid over the side and that person who suggested this, other persons think about it, that the fermentation process improves it and it can fit in here later on at another stage. In other words, I'm saying don't discard partly psychologically and partly you may want to use it. You know, it may fit in later even though you can't see it. And this is a part of the difficulty we have as we individually think through this process. We don't see all the possibilities down the road. And some of these can be significant contributions down the road that we can't even see at this point. And that's a part of what I'm trying to say. Right, yeah. We have to hear it, acknowledge that we heard it, understood what was said. We're going to deal with it later. And quite often that idea gets picked up by somebody else who credits, builds on it, reintroduces it. It fits, but somewhat different than what was proposed back here. In other words, we keep the whole process moving rather than stop to go down the side roads and fight the battle. Did I see someone? Yeah. There are 2 points here that we need to be careful of in terms of digressions at this point in terms of building alliances. One is we always think we have enough, and we're usually wrong. In other words, the temptation basically is, here is a point of discontent, here's a way to ease the discontent, here are some good people, they're good because they agree with us, here are some good people you see who agree in this, reinforce the idea that this is the appropriate way to deal with this point of discontent back here. Let's go. What are we waiting for? That is one of the ways to cut your own throat. There are some others, several others. It's particularly important, you see, that we think this through in terms of timing, how fast we can move, and particularly, and this again touches a little bit on the experience of your being here outside the parish for these days. One of the most common things I see in the church is the committee that's appointed to deal with a particular issue. They make a very careful, thorough, and excellent in quality study, come up with this recommendation, which from their point of view and from the point of view of any informed person who's been through the process they've been through is obviously the best solution. Therefore, since we spent really more time than we intended to, you know, studying this and working on it, let's get it before the people and get it approved, you know, well, it's too late this morning, but we can do it right after lunch. And then we have it rejected depending on the vote and so forth, like 4-1 or 5-1 or 10-1 or these kinds of portions. Which says, in effect, this group went through the process, got way down the road, and the rest of the congregation are back here. And therefore, it's important, you see, for this core group of people, whatever it may be, committee, task force, whatever you call it, to spend some time talking with and responding to the questions and concerns of people who have not been involved in the process. There's a famous essay of about 15 years ago in the field of public administration, or maybe it's 20 years ago now, called Milling Around, and that's the title of it, just simply Milling Around. And the thesis of it very simply is that people have to have some time to mill around between when they're confronted with a proposal and they have to make a decision. You can use whatever term you want. But as soon as we confront people with a proposal and ask for action immediately, we are almost guaranteeing a negative response. The one major exception to this is a crisis. But unless you have a crisis which changes all the rules, the shorter that period of time between the proposal and the response that's expected from people, the more likely the response is to be negative. Now, obviously, you can stretch this milling around time out to a point of, you know, beyond the point of diminishing returns. But I'm simply saying that we recognize the significance of the milling around time for people to think about it, reflect on it, ask questions, make comments, and again, this is a very threatening comment, perhaps even once again improve it. You know, after we have already perfected, and we've been surprised how much the committee did to what may have been what we thought was our proposal at improving it by rather radical changes, you know, and now, by golly, it is perfect. And then the possibility exists over here that in the milling around process, it may even be improved again. And so you allow some time for this. And the last comment I'd make in this regard is, again, and you can use whatever words you want to use, but this applies at least as much in Missouri Synod congregations as it does anywhere else. The person a few of you heard me describe before that I identify simply as Uncle Harold. And nothing moves without Uncle Harold's okay. And Uncle Harold may be a woman even, more likely to be a family, maybe one individual. Uncle Harold has a veto. Now, here we need to look at the dynamics of one part of the process of how ideas get introduced in an organization and carried through. It is much, 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 much easier to veto something than it is to initiate and get adoption. We have all kinds of forms of minority veto. Most pastors, and as I see it, almost all pastors in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, have a veto power. To me, this is sort of one of the distinctive characteristics of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Now, that doesn't mean that the pastor has a lot of power to get things done. That is a whole different agenda. All I'm saying is that the pastor tends to have a veto power all by himself. He doesn't need any allies. Uncle Harold quite often has a veto power all by himself, and he doesn't need any allies. But if you want to get something done, then we're talking partly about the possibility, and here again, you know, comes your doctrine of man and also how you feel about people, as to, you look at Uncle Harold, and do you see him as an unredeemable sinner, or do you see him in some other light? And I have met a lot of Uncle Harolds in my life, and I've been amazed at how many of these people, if they were approached in time, were open to new ideas. If they're boxed in the corner, they also know how to fight. And they particularly know how to veto proposals. And therefore, a part of the milling around period of time is to deal with what I describe simply as Uncle Harold. Now, let's move over for just a moment and talk about the teams that are here from the districts, because this is related to what we've been talking about here. It seems to me that one of the possibilities, as far as the team is concerned, would be that in at least one instance, and hopefully two or three or four, some members of the team could be present in the parish of Pastor A of this team somewhere in the next 3 or 4 months to help partly with the perspective of an outsider, partly to refine, partly to reinforce certain proposals. And it seems to me that with the experience you've had here, you shouldn't fail to make use of some other members of the team. Now, in some cases, the distance is such that you couldn't possibly expect to make use of more than one other person in the team. In some cases, where people are scattered over an area that's only maybe 200 or 300 miles across, then it's possible to talk about all the members of the team. And if you do this, then I would suggest that you build in a period of reflection afterwards. In other words, if, for example, two members of the team are coming over to your parish on a certain Tuesday in November to meet with your leadership on Tuesday evening, build in later that evening or maybe on Wednesday morning a period where you and these other members of the team who were there reflect on what happened. In other words, don't build in just the action side of this, build in the reflection side of that model. Now, if I may move on and suggest in very specific terms a couple of agenda items here. And again, I try to do this in terms both of the district and the parish, but largely the parish. I would suggest that for a pastor, as I said earlier, you boil it down to one or two, and today, in terms of your time today, take one of these, not two, just simply one, and begin to work it through with the other people in the team as to how I might, in my situation, begin to introduce this idea that I picked up here this time at Concordia and how I would go about this. In other words, deal not so much with the content of it, but the procedure. And you have then the benefit, you see, of the other members of the team here in terms of how you go about this. It may or may not be appropriate that you may want to do something in the same way as far as the district is concerned. I don't know enough about those situations to have any kind of positive suggestions. But I see the possibility that it may be that there would be some things as far as the district agenda which might be discussed the same way as to one thing that we would propose to bring before the district, and then we begin to discuss strategy, tactics, whatever word you want to use, procedure as to how we go about this. And I would suggest that you limit this to one and try to work it through today, getting the advice, the counsel of other people on the members of the group you're with. Now, if you still have time for one other item on the agenda as far as your groups are concerned, or as far as on your way home and what you're thinking about on the way home, then I'd bring it down to simply this question, and sort of a two-part question. At the end of 1973, in your parish, what are you going to celebrate that your parish was able to do during the year, and how you do this? In other words, what will be lifted up to give thanks to God for both the opportunities and the resources, and how you do this? I've mentioned this before with some of you, mentioned it briefly in here one time. This, it seems to me, is one of the easiest approaches to increasing the capability of the congregation I know, that I've ever encountered, where instead of dwelling on what we ought to do or we might have done or we should do, we spend some time giving thanks for what we have been able to accomplish and lifting these up in a very positive, affirmative sense as far as celebration is concerned in the congregation. Some congregations do this on Sunday morning, more often at a special event type of worship service, some evening during the week. There's a whole range of possibilities here. I think it's particularly significant that we do this in the smaller congregations, in the congregations that are part of a dual parish, in this type of situation, where we tend to spend an awful lot of time brooding about our inadequacies. In the larger parish, larger congregation, this tends to happen more or less unintentionally, in a sort of haphazard way, to some degree, and is a rather significant affirming process. But in the smaller congregations, it tends not to happen. And we tend to lift up our disappointments and our problems and our inadequacies and our limited life expectancy and all these kinds of things. And if I may make the reference back here to what I was talking about a little bit yesterday with some of you, and I finally got around to look at the cover in this and discovered that I should have looked sooner. This came from a place called Concordia Theological Seminary in Springfield, Illinois. And sorry about that. And is entitled Toward Excellence in the Ministry. I came from an ALC district staff person. That's why I didn't have that clear in my mind, and he covered up the title with his note. One of the things I mentioned in this yesterday with some of you was that a major point in this is the expectations of the pastor are very clearly related affirmatively toward the level of effectiveness. In other words, how the pastor sees the world, I use that in very general terms, tends to be a very significant factor in trying to predict effectiveness. I think the same thing is true as far as the parish is concerned. And I would suggest it may even be more true because I think we have parishes that are doing quite a bit in spite of the pastor, or in spite of the pastor's low expectations. But simply that as we do this and lift up, you know, what are we going to celebrate? How are we going to do it? We begin to raise the level of expectations. And I find this almost too difficult to, too hard to overemphasize, because if you were to use the concept of a cost-benefit formula as to what does it cost to do something and what are the benefits, this is one of those where the scale is weighed very heavily on the benefit side. The input, the efforts required to accomplish this is very minimal. The results are very significant. Now, I'd like to answer three questions, and then we wind this up, and these are all rather simple kinds of questions. One is the reference Paul made. I'll be around here today. Someone has asked for me to be with them from 10 to 10:30 and somebody else at 10:30. But other than that, I don't have any schedules for the time you're in your groups, and if you want me to meet with you, I'd be glad to do this. Someone asked about the parish paper, and there are some forms here if you're interested in the parish paper. I'm not trying to peddle it, but they're here. And someone else asked about the cards I described in regard to how people in a congregation may sit down with the pastor and talk about the allocation of the pastor's time. And we spent a little time on that yesterday morning. We have two sets of cards. One deals with the purpose. The procedure is the same. One deals with what is the purpose of this congregation, and the other deals with the priorities of the pastor's time. And these are $1 for 10. I don't have any with me, but if you want the address, my address is on here, and just, you know, put either pastor cards or parish cards and send $1, and we'll send you 10 of them. And I mention this simply to respond to some questions.
Okay, yes.
$1 each. Yeah. In other words, by the time we pay for the printing and the postage, we just about come out even, as long as we don't have highly priced clerical help to do this. Any other leftovers? Yes. Yes, I might. If I were reminded, I would. If anyone wants to talk about district organization and bylaws and these kinds of things for a district, some of us will be having lunch together, and if you want to join us, we'll be glad to have you. And the agenda there is district organization, district bylaws. Thank you.
Two announcements of reminder that your support groups will be meeting in different rooms today. I said this earlier, just reiterated. It's the rooms that are in the parentheses, if I'm correct, in your booklet. The evaluation sheets that I said earlier I'd hand out at the end are on their way from the print shop, still have not arrived. What I'll try to do is visit each of the rooms this morning and drop off the evaluation sheets at that time. May I also have your attention, just a minute, if I may. I pulled a real boo-boo on Tuesday when we began. We had the services of Mel Spain with us that day, and suddenly that day was over with and he was gone. And I failed to express appreciation to him for being with us. I did that privately. This is the last chance that Lyle will be with us as a plenary group. Perhaps be around during the evaluation, but that may be a little bit of a different setting. So I want to be sure to take this opportunity to express my appreciation to Lyle Schaller and to say before you, and I'd sure give you the chance to say thanks to him for spending the 4 days with us. And